Senator Mitt Romney, thank you very much for being here today.
Happy to join you.
You have been home in Utah for the past little while. I know you've been doing some town halls, and you gave a speech at the Sutherland Institute. Your visit also coincides with a stop in Utah by Vice President Mike Pence, who came here to promote the Trump administration's U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal, the USMCA, to replace NAFTA. And I know that you are a proponent of this plan. Why does this deal matter, or why is it necessary, and what kind of events were you involved in with the vice president's visit?
Well, I went to his speech, and I thought he did a very nice job. But the deal itself is an improvement on NAFTA, and I don't think there's much argument about that. I don't know why we haven't had a vote on it yet. Speaker Pelosi apparently doesn't want to give the president a win, if you will. But this is good for the auto industry because it requires more local U.S. content in auto production. And it's also good for agriculture. It opens up markets in both Canada and Mexico for dairy and for other products. So it's good for Utah. We send about $2.5 billion worth of goods to Mexico and Canada. This will kick it up almost immediately to $3 billion, and it'll go up from there. So it's good for us. It's good for other parts of the country that manufacture products and as well as our manufacturing. So it's kind of a win for everybody.
You pointed out that slight hiccup, which is that it needs to be approved by both the House and Senate. In the House, of course, there's the Democratic majority, and they have had concerns over the impact of this deal on labor and the environment. Can it win approval in that chamber?
You know, I believe that if it gets to the floor in the House, it will win easily. In part because the Midwestern Congress people are going to vote for it because it's good for manufacturing. People in other states that have manufacturing will vote for it. And, of course, those in ag states will also think it's a big positive. And the complaint that comes from Speaker Pelosi is that, gee, it didn't do as much as she'd like to have it do. But I don't think there's an argument that's been made that it's not an improvement on NAFTA. There's some that say, let's just get rid of NAFTA altogether. That's not going to happen. But this is an improvement on NAFTA and would be a step forward.
Politics could play a hand, though. I mean, the 2020 election is coming up, and giving the president a win might be a problem for Democrats.
Well, I think that may be in the back of Speaker Pelosi's mind, which is we'd rather complain about things right now than have something that clearly would be seen as a win for the president. And so she'd like it just to sort of disappear, I think. I can't tell you what's in her mind.
Right.
But I think in the final analysis, you're going to see this approved, because otherwise going back to NAFTA would not be good for labor, would not be good for agriculture, and would be a real step back.
In his visit to New Mexico just before coming to Salt Lake City, the vice president touted the USMCA as a way to bolster the American energy economy. He said that the deal would result in more energy infrastructure to perhaps move product to Mexico. And energy policy ties directly into something I wanted to ask you about today, which is climate change. You took a position this week in remarks at the Sutherland Institute that put you in kind of an unusual camp among Republicans. You are someone who acknowledges the science showing that climate change is happening, which isn't actually unusual. You go a step further, though, and you say that it is caused by human activities. Is that an evolving position, or is that a case where scientific findings had convinced you a long time ago, Senator Romney?
Is a long time ago. I indicated that human activity contributes to climate change in a significant way. I don't know exactly how much, but I also make the comment, I hope climate change is significantly caused by human activity, because if it's not, there's nothing we can do about it. So let's hope we can have some influence. And then the question is, okay, what things can we do that are probably good things to do anyway that will improve our environment generally and also contribute to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions? The challenge we face, of course, is that the U.S. represents only about 13% of the CO2 emissions from the planet. And in order for there to be a change, we're going to have to find a way for the entire world to dramatically reduce our CO2 emissions. And that's hard when you have the developing nations, Brazil, Indonesia, China, India, if you will, bringing in washing machines and dishwashers and air conditioners and cars. And so you're going to see CO2 go through the roof unless we find new technologies, whether they're in solar and wind and battery storage and carbon recapture, whatever those technologies are, we're going to have to find new ways to dramatically reduce our emissions.
You know, we had a global accord. We had the Paris Climate Accord. The U.S. pulled out of it. Was that a mistake?
I believe it was. I don't think that the accord itself was going to have a major impact. It certainly would not have had a major impact on CO2 emissions, but it was important to have the world talking and coming together and setting goals and hopefully, in many cases, reaching those goals. I think it was a mistake for us as a leader of the free world, not to be a leader on this topic. I said so at the time. I think so now. But I believe that the area that we can lead in will be in the investment in technologies that may not only help us reduce our emissions, but get other countries to find ways to do so as well.
You also suggested the idea of a carbon tax possibly being a way to try and address this.
You know, it's something I'm looking at and studying. The idea that's been proposed by a number of think tanks, as well as the oil companies, believe it or not, is tax the oil companies and tax the energy producers based on the CO2 they emit, about $50 a ton, and then take that money and give it back to the consumers. So there's it's called a carbon tax and carbon dividend. So the money all goes back to consumers. And a small amount, about 10% of the total, would go back to the communities that are affected by the change of energy outlook in our country. So coal country, for instance, would be given a real hand up to make sure that that part of the country is able to stand on its feet again after coal sees a slow decline. So that's something we're looking at. Whether we'll finally be able to come up with something that actually works is another matter, but it's something we're studying.
That idea of helping out coal country or helping out the energy-producing regions of the U.S. is something that, you know, I know you're going to the Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute after this. I know that Natalie Gochner, who is the director of that institute and also one of the hosts of a program on this station, called it a moral obligation to help the people in those regions as we make that transition, or as we try to make that transition away from fossil fuels.
Well, and we're seeing that already, as you know. I mean, coal is already suffering. We're going to have one of our major power plants in Utah that sends power to California is going to be closing, and that means a reduction in coal production. And so these parts of our country and of our state are already suffering in many cases. And we don't want to do what we did with the auto industry, which is there were big changes in the auto industry due to that NAFTA as well as due to automation. And we just watched as major communities were very badly hurt. And we needed to help people get on their feet again. And we need to do that for parts of our economy where there's a dramatic change.
Some of the predictions around climate change are dire. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for example, has put this very stark language out there, talking about action being overdue. How concerned about, you know, the effects of climate change are you in the immediate and near term?
Well, I don't know how fast we're going to see the impacts that are being spoken of. But I think if they're at all correct, and you know, science has a lot better sense of what's going to happen than I do as a politician, but the scientists are almost uniform in their concern that this is happening faster than they expected and that the impacts could be dramatic. And so that suggests we got to do something. We can't just hope it's not going to happen. Sure, we all hope it's not going to happen, but that's not an answer. That's not a solution. Right. So we've got to take action, and that's something I'm working on. And other Republican senators, Lindsey Graham, for instance, and I are working together talking about some way to encourage investment in new technologies in our universities, in our think tanks, and some of our research centers to say, hey, are there places we can improve? And, you know, a few years ago, the cost of taking carbon out of the air was about $500 a ton. It's now down to $100 a ton. If we can get it down to like $50 a ton, it becomes economic to have a dramatic change as a result of that technology.
An incentive there to make that happen.
Yeah, you bet.
There's sort of a parallel to be made between hoping that something happens and banking on winning the lottery for your retirement. There's some I can't make that joke.
Well, a lot of it is people say, well, I'm going to be gone by the time that comes around. It's like, yeah, but we do have a responsibility to coming generations. We are stewards of the earth. And if we can make modest changes now that have other benefits like reducing pollution, reducing inversions, for instance, in Salt Lake Valley, those are things we ought to do anyway.
I want Senator Romney to turn now to something that this is a vast turn from the conversation we were just having. But this inevitably comes back into public view and then fades and then comes back again. And that is the topic of guns and mass shootings in America. A few weeks ago, we had two back to back and actually three in the same week. In their wake, you said that you were committed to being a constructive voice working toward some sort of action. And my question to you here is simply, what is feasible? And just for context, the reason that I ask that is because, you know, back in 2013 when we had the Sandy Hook shooting and there were elementary school children who were gunned down, Congress wasn't able to get a background check bill passed, even after a number of, you know, casualties and a lot of public scrutiny on it. what is actually feasible now as a result of, you know, the latest round of mass shootings in America?
Well, let me begin by just noting how outrageous and unthinkable these acts have been. I mean, I have five sons, and the idea of one of them being taken or one of my 24 grandchildren being taken is unimaginable. And the pain that is being felt across our country and the fear of our kids, in many cases, going to school is something that is just awful. What's going to happen? In my opinion, Washington is responsible for the background check system, and that is where we need to have improvement. I said during my campaign I was going to be in favor of improving our background check system. I am continue to have that feeling, and I'm fighting for and will fight with other legislators to encourage them to support a background check technology improvement, and that is something that I think has prospect of making it in Washington. I know the president the other day said he was backing away from that, but I'd like to get something to his desk that he could sign. I think there's a good shot of that happening. Other legislation that relates to school safety and guns generally, I think is best dealt with at the state level. We have such differing points of view across the country that the prospect of Washington taking on something of that nature is extremely remote. And states are making their own decisions. Some states have red flag laws. Others ban certain types of weapons. I think the Utah legislature is in a better position than Washington's Congress to deal with any changes that might be of interest there.
Do you support a red flag law? This is the idea of having law enforcement get guns out of hands of people who pose an imminent danger. Is that something that you think is a good idea?
I don't think it's a Washington proposal. I think it's something that you'd have to – each state will have to find its own way of sorting through the real due process issues, which is, I think, pretty clear. Everybody's in favor of saying, hey, let's make sure that bad people don't have guns. But then the question is, how do you determine who's a bad person? What kind of process do you have to go through? How do we protect people's rights? So it gets really complicated. But there are, I believe, 17 states have put in place some form of a red flag law. And understanding how it's working in those states may be instructive to states that are looking at it. But I'm not bringing that to Washington. It will, in my opinion, have no prospect of success there.
All right, that's a kind of a no comment. You're leaving it in the hands of the state government at that point. Yeah. You know, in the wake of the shootings that took place earlier this month, I attended a press conference where a variety of gun reform advocates spoke, and they lauded you for being willing to have a conversation specifically about guns. And if you don't mind, I'd like to play a quick clip of this. This is Nancy Halden. She is with the Gun Violence Prevention Center here in the state of Utah.
In all three mass shootings, angry, extremist young men had easy access to military-style weapons with multi-capacity magazines. Our politicians have been quick to blame mental illness and violent video games. However, the rates of mental illness are the same worldwide, and other countries are not experiencing mass shootings at the rate that the U.S. is. The critical difference is easy access to and lethality of weapons that are being used in our mass shootings.
She's trying to poke holes in the kind of, I don't want to call it scapegoating, but the maybe distraction that happens in the wake of mass shootings and mental illness, video games. Just this past week, Utah Governor Gary Herbert said that we should be looking at both of those things. Is it safe to say that, you know, in other countries, it is the lack of access to guns that keeps those places from achieving anything like our levels of mass shootings?
I can't speak for why other countries have differing levels of mass shootings than we do. There's certainly an element of, if you will, sort of copycat that's been, I think, in part to blame for what's gone on. People are seeing these things in the news. They're seeing people become famous. It's something that they think about that they wouldn't have thought about 10 years ago or 20 years ago because it just wasn't as prevalent. I don't know how much of that is involved, but there's some things you can deal with and there's some things that you know are contributing, but you can't do anything about it. Mental illness, for instance, is certainly a contributing factor, but we're not going to eliminate mental illness. All right, that's going to always be there. I think, again, that the federal government has responsibility for background checks to make sure that people that shouldn't have guns can't get them. Then the states have responsibility for saying, how are we going to keep our schools safe and how are we going to keep our public meeting places safe? And states are going to come up with ideas that are best upon the thinking of the people of each state.
Two more proposals that I see splashing across the pages of social media sometimes: banning high-capacity magazines. These are the amount of bullets that a gun can hold, or reinstituting the assault weapons ban. Your thoughts on those items, Senator Romney?
Again, these are the kinds of issues that I think have to be dealt with state by state. Some states have assault weapon bans. Looking to see what kind of impact that had in those states would perhaps be instructive to our legislature here. My own view is that bump stocks, for instance, are something that should not be in the public domain, and I do support federal action to remove bump stocks such that they would not be available.
Okay. Senator Mitt Romney, our time is up, but I really appreciate your carving out some space for me today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.